Welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. October 11th is National Coming Out Day, and tonight in studio, we have someone who will not only share her coming out story, she'll share her passion for writing.
That's right. In studio, we have Michelle Wing as our guest, poet extraordinaire, and organizer of the Changing Hurt to Hope Writers Speak Out Against Domestic Violence campaign, sponsored by the YWCA here in Sonoma County. So, hello, Michelle.
Hi, thanks for having me here tonight.
Yeah, welcome. We're really, really, really happy to have you.
That's right, because Michelle will, yes, discuss Changing Hurt to Hope, and she will also be sharing some of her creative pieces as well. So we're looking forward to that. So if you want to be moved, be affected, please stay tuned. But first, here's news and events with Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Maralia.
I have found Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
Good evening, this is Greg Maralia with your Outbeat Radio News for this Sunday, October 6th, 2013. An investigation by Right Wing Watch, a website from the progressive group People for the American Way, uncovered National Organization for Marriage President Brian Brown in a video interview in Russia, arguing that LGBT people should be stopped from adopting children. The country soon afterward passed a law banning adoptions by any foreigners who have come from a set of countries where marriage equality is legal, including the United States. Most recently, Russia has halted adoptions to Sweden because of this law. Brown was quoted as saying, "Right now you're having to fight about adoption, but the adoption issue is indivisible from the marriage issue. If you don't defend your values now, I'm afraid we're going to see the very negative developments all over the world." Right Wing Watch also found a transcript of a speech given by Brown while in Russia. Brown argued before a joint committee of the Duma's Committee on Foreign Affairs and its Committee on Families that allowing equal rights on any front would lead to persecution of religious people. Brown pins his argument on the supposed need to protect children. Brown was quoted as saying, "We have actually seen that in some schools they are talking to children about homosexuality, but in fact they don't have a right to learn about such things until a certain age." He added, "I think that this visit, the invitation to visit Russia, will enable the development of this movement around the world. We will band together. We will defend our children and their normal civil rights. Every child should have the right to have normal parents, a mother and a father." And it was 15 years ago tonight that a 21-year-old college student named Matthew Shepard walked into a bar in Laramie, Wyoming, and was approached by two strangers of the same age who seduced him away, only to viciously beat him and leave him to die 5 days later. The two men, Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson, were arrested almost immediately and ultimately were convicted of murder, robbery, and kidnapping. Many people have tried to tell the story about what happened that night, in print, in movies, and on television. But until now, only a book written by Matthew's mother, Judy Shepard, has offered firsthand information about the truth. This weekend, however, a documentary produced by a group of Matthew's friends made its world premiere right here in Mill Valley at the Mill Valley Film Festival. Matthew Shepard is a friend of mine is a documentary filled with never-before-seen pictures and video. Their narrative is provided by some of Matthew's closest friends, including Michelle Hossaway, Zaina Barkawi, and Jason Marsden. It provides firsthand truth about who Matt Shepard, the person behind the icon Matthew Shepard, really was. Alan Johnson of the San Francisco Chronicle said, "Hossaway's film is both an intimate portrait of her friend and a personal journey." Much has happened in the decade and a half since this notorious hate crime was committed. The Matthew Shepard Foundation, a nonprofit founded by Matthew's parents, has worked tirelessly to expand federal hate crime legislation, which it accomplished in 2009, and continues to work to replace hate with understanding, acceptance, and compassion. What happened in Laramie, Wyoming in 1998 also became the subject of the now famous Laramie Project play, written and produced by the Tectonic Theater Project. On Tuesday of this last week, a group of University of Mississippi students, including members of the football team, disrupted the Ole Miss Theater Department's performance of The Laramie Project. Last Tuesday evening's performance was ruined with heckling and homophobic remarks by members of the team. According to the play's director and theater faculty member, Roy Ledbetter, some audience members used derogatory slurs and heckled both cast members and the characters that were portraying for their body types and sexual orientations. Ledbetter said the audience's reactions included borderline hate speech. Junior theater major Garrison Gibson said, quote, "I'm the only gay person on the cast. I play a gay character in the show. And to be ridiculed like that was something that really made me realize that some people at Ole Miss and in Mississippi still can't accept me for who I am." The Ole Miss Dean of Students said that the university was looking into the incident. And finally, I'm From Driftwood.com is hosting a house party featuring its founder Nathan Mansky and special guest Stuart Milk, the nephew of Harvey Milk, on Wednesday, October 16th from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. Proceeds will benefit I'mFromDriftwood.com, a national nonprofit organization dedicated to saving lives and empowering communities. You can learn more at I'mFromDriftwood.com. For more information about local LGBT events happening here in the North Bay, be sure to visit GaySonoma.com. And if you have news or an event you'd like to share with our listeners, be sure to tell us about it by going to our website at OutbeatNews.com. And follow us all week long on Facebook and Twitter for the latest LGBT news and information from here in the North Bay and beyond. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia. Now back to Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Grayer.
Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
Hello, everybody. We are back in studio with our guest, Michelle Wing, and you are listening to Living Proof with Dr. Diana Grayer, my wife, and me. I'm Sheridan Gold. So welcome back, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Michelle, I mean, we just to let everybody know, we just had engagement with Michelle last Thursday.
Yes.
At Changing Hurt to Hope. And so we want to start just there.
Okay.
So tell the audience about Changing Hurt to Hope, what it's all about, and how it was birthed, how it came about.
So Changing Hurt to Hope, I volunteer with the YWCA Sonoma County, which is the main provider of services for domestic violence victims and their families in Sonoma County. And 4 years ago, I'd done this kind of work before with other agencies, but 4 years ago when I started working with the Y, I thought, you know, I'm a writer. I want to do something that uses that skill, that talent, and really tap into that as a way to make a difference in the domestic violence work that I do. And we were brainstorming new ways to do outreach during Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So I came up with this idea of having writers address the topic of domestic violence. And we coined the name Changing Hurt to Hope, Writers Speak Out Against Domestic Violence. And that first year, just sent out a notice saying, please submit your memoir, your poetry, your fiction, having no idea if anyone would, and they did. The first year we did it in three cities, in Cloverdale, in Santa Rosa, and in Sebastopol, which is where we continued for the next 3 years. This year we expanded and added a venue in Sonoma, which is where we just met on Thursday night for the first time. And what's been fascinating for me, and a number of different things, first of all, people from all over the county have responded. We've had every city in the county that has been represented. Initially, I thought that it would be mostly survivors, you know, mostly women who had gone through this that would write, and maybe some writers who would just see it as sort of as a writing prompt, you know, that a creative writing prompt. But what ended up happening is that on top of that, we had the whole gamut of other people in the community that are affected. We had a brother writing about losing his adult sister to her batterer. We had social workers writing about dealing with children in the school system. We had a parent writing about adopting a child who had been taken from a home where there had been domestic violence, and the pain and heartache that she was going through trying to raise this child who had been so emotionally scarred. And so what you were really seeing by these pieces, just, you know, without meaning to, we got this cross-section of the way that domestic violence does not affect simply the two people in the relationship, but really ripples throughout the community, affecting all of us, that violence just spreads and touches everybody. And so that was really profound for me.
What a gift. I mean, we've been participating for the 4 years,
mm-hmm.
and just to hear you talk about it, I'm being moved by it, you mm-hmm. know what you're saying, because I'm there witnessing mm-hmm. the stories.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seemed like it's such a need.
Yeah. And it's interesting as well, something that has happened this year. We've had a number of the writers who participated in the first year or the second year who have come back now this year and are writing, and their piece this year is saying, this is what happened to me because I wrote that first year, because I stood up that first year and told my story. And you know, I made that step, and then I realized, oh, this part of my life now must change, or now I must move forward here. And for me, I mean, I'm a survivor myself, so what I know is that words healed me. My writing brought me back from the brink, and I knew that that's why I brought this forward as a project, is that I truly believed that these words had, that the act of writing had the power to save, you know, that creativity has this amazing healing, nurturing ability. And I'm seeing that. I'm seeing that. I mean, I'm not doing anything else for these writers. You know, I'm not holding therapy sessions. I'm not giving, you know, providing my phone number as a crisis line. I'm not doing anything else for them. I'm just saying, here's this venue, write it down. I'll give you a safe place to come and read. Mm. And it's changing their lives. And it's also changed in the lives of the people who come and listen. And for me, that's a powerful, powerful message.
Mm-hmm. And given the people there, courage, who the witnessing, courage to come out and share their story.
Exactly.
I mean, I've heard a few people coming forth and say, hey, yeah, I can do this now.
Yeah.
You know?
One of the people that I was moved by was wondering if you could talk about the evolution of how this happened. But I think a mother wrote and then her daughter.
Yeah.
Could you talk about a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is really an amazing story. There's a woman who was in a group. I did a journaling workshop with a group of women through the YWCA a couple of years ago. And this woman, I had encouraged her to then come forward and write for Hurt to Hope. So she did that. And last year she wrote this amazing story about the particular incident that she, that ended in, it was a day when her ex-husband attempted to kill both her and her two young daughters by ramming his truck into their van. And then when they got out of the van, he actually tried to run them over with the truck. And she was, so she told that story last year at Changing Hurt to Hope. It was just chilling. When she was reading the story, her younger daughter was there in the audience, Julie. And Julie burst into tears while she was reading it. And Diane said to the audience, she knew what I was going to read. We talked about it ahead of time. but there is still much healing to do. And when she finished reading, she went to her and consoled her. And then at the intermission, this young girl, who was only 12 years old at the time, came up to me and said, "I'm going to write my story. Mm-hmm. I will write my story next year for you." So this year, Julie contacted me, now 13 years old. And she had been 4 years old at the time of this incident. And she came up to me and she said, "I wrote my story, Michelle. I'm ready. I've been working on it all year." Mm-hmm. And she got up there on Thursday night and she did it. She read this story. And there was not a dry eye in the house, let me tell you, this young woman standing up there to speak her truth. Mm-hmm. And there was actually a spontaneous standing ovation when she finished. I was just so proud of her, so moved by her courage and her, it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, we got some wet eyes in here now.
Everybody crying in the studio here.
Yeah, I mean, we were there to witness it. It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. So many more people need to be out to see it and witness the stories.
So what I would really like to say to all of you, Julie is going to be reading two more times. We have an event coming up this Thursday in Santa Rosa. She won't be there that night, but the event in Santa Rosa is... at Sutter Health on Airway Drive. We'll be reading on the 17th in Cloverdale at the Cloverdale Arts Alliance Gallery, which is on the main boulevard. And on the 24th at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts in their new location on High Street in the old Veterans Building. All of the events have a reception at 6:30 and the actual event starts at 7. Julie will be reading in Cloverdale and in Sebastopol. So if you want to hear that amazing story, I encourage you to come. But any of them, we'd love to have you. For exact details and everything, you can go onto our website at www.ywcasc.org.
And this is a free event?
And it is free. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But donations are welcome.
Donations always welcome. But please, we would love to have your support. And amazing, amazing events. And Diana will also be reading, your host tonight. And Sheridan plays a beautiful Native American flute and African drum with that. Mm-hmm. So.
I'm just blown away by it all. Still, it's just a beautiful process, and that more people need to be out there. So, Michelle, I'm just curious to talk to you a little bit about your process of writing, because you did share that you were in a domestic relationship where you intimate partner abuse going on. And so during the process of that, were you writing, or after the fact, the writing served you well? I'm just curious about your process and if you can share that.
It was more after. It's funny. It's interesting. One of the women that shared in the expressions group that I was in, it was very interesting. We had this journaling project for women, and one of the things that came up for her was that she said at the end of it, she said, she had stopped doing all of those kind of things because in the abusive relationship, her partner read her journals, destroyed her artwork, that was part of the abuse. And so she had stopped being creative. And so, you know, there's that fear, I think, a lot of times with people, you know, when they're in an abusive relationship. You don't want to put anything down because you don't want it to be used against you. So I know for me, my writing came after, and my initial attempts were very raw and, not very poetic. and very dark and kind of just purging. Mm. Purging. There was a lot of purging. I did a lot of journaling. Mm-hmm. And then I started actually getting to a point where I had enough distance that I was able to start creating. Mm. I was able to get to a point where I could look at it from a place that I could transform it. Mm-hmm. And that was really powerful when I was able to do that. So it's funny because some of the things that I write now and read, people think when I read them, they sound very present. Uh-huh. But they're things that happened many years ago. But the way I read them and the way I write them sound very present. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes my audience feels like, oh, I'm so sorry, you know. No, it's okay. It's okay. I've already worked through this. But it's, I mean, it's good. I'm glad that I'm communicating when I'm communicating, because the emotion is still, it's real. It's real and it's there and it's what I want to communicate. But it's something that I've already been able to come to terms with creatively. And it took me an amount of time to get to that point where I was able to express it appropriately. Mm-hmm. Am I making sense?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, you are a beautiful reader of your poetry, for sure.
Oh,
so
thank you.
Are we going to, should we?
Well, I was thinking since we just complimented Michelle out of the yin-yang, I mean, it would be really nice to hear something. Would this be a good time for you to share one of your pieces? And then we'll take a music break after that?
Sure. What would you like me to read?
Well, anything that you brought with maybe an introduction to how it came to be, I think would be great.
Do you want the longer piece? Or?
Sure, that'd be terrific.
Okay. This is a longer piece, and I used this for Hurt to Hope last year. And I was thinking about how rage, how it took me a long time to own my rage, that for a long time I felt like rage was inappropriate. So I wanted to write about that. I wanted to explore that. So it's called How I Became a Poet. After the hurt and before the healing, there is rage. If you had asked me to don that cloak, I would have said no. But it falls about my shoulders uninvited, comes to me as I walk the city streets. It envelops me, wraps me in its fury. In an art therapy group, the counselor asks us to take turns lying down on large pieces of butcher block paper while someone traces the outline of our bodies with a fat black marker. Our assignment is to place emotions in the form. I fill my head with anxiety, dread, despair, depression, and suicidality. There is not enough room for all the dark words. I move down to the stomach and chest to add in hurt, lost, scared, alone. I am very aware of the imbalance, the negativity, so I search for something, anything positive. I look at my right arm and decide to grace it with my creativity, my desire to write. Even if at this moment I am unable to write a single word except big block letters. almost as an afterthought, I draw a small spiral in my gut, and in tiny controlled print, I label it rage. Mm-hmm. The first time I feel its presence, I am alone. A well-intentioned friend gives me a videotape of lesbian soft porn shorts. She thinks I need to get rid of the good girl image, push the boundaries, put some edge into my life. I take the tape home, and after leaving it on my shelf for several weeks, I finally put it into the VCR one night. The third movie depicts an S&M scene between girlfriends. The dominant woman calls the submissive one ugly, degrading names. The sex looks like rape. I do not care that it is supposedly consensual. It is asking me to find pleasure in exactly the kind of torture I have escaped. I am momentarily frozen. Then I awake and eject the tape. It's not enough just to throw it away. I go to the kitchen and find a hammer. I smash the case until it is in splinters. I pull out mile after mile of offending tape until I am sitting in a sea of smut. The destruction helps my body work out its disgust and anger. Completely spent, I walk to the trash dumpster, trailing my ribbons of despair. I am sitting on the living room floor in a two-story apartment unit with a friend. I hear a man yell, abusive, foul language, a harsh voice coming from outside. I race to the window, arriving just in time to see this stranger grab his female partner and throw her hard onto the asphalt. I am out the door and screaming in a deep, guttural voice, standing on the cement balcony, "Stop!" He ignores me as he kicks her. No, not again. Not one more. The stairs are too far away. I put my foot up on the railing, ready to catapult myself over the edge. I am caught in midair, my arms pinioned behind my back, the whispered words, "No, baby, this isn't the way." My male friend pulls me away from my attempted leap. I am kicking and yelling, but he is stronger than me, and I can only struggle and cry out in his arms. Neighbors begin to peek out from behind curtains. Someone has called 911. It is too late. The stranger has pushed the woman into a car, and they have driven away. I am in San Francisco at 3 p.m. near the intersection of 16th and Mission Streets. It's sunny, and the sidewalks are filled with pedestrians. As I pass a small shop, the fire escape drops down, and a man and a woman descend. It gets my attention. I step back into the shadows to watch. The man hits the concrete first. He is holding the woman's wrist in his hands. She's wearing a short skirt, and her legs and arms are covered in bruises. He pulls her onto the sidewalk and then out into the traffic. She's trying to yank away from him, pleading with him to let her go. He is dragging her across the street. There are people everywhere. No one looks at them. I feel the anger rising up in me. I step out between the cars and follow. They head into the alley on the other side, the man forcing her every step. At the opening of the alley, I stand, feet apart, hands on hips, and in a huge, booming voice, I call out, "Hey, buddy." He stops. He turns around and sees me there. I say, "Let her go." He says, "You don't understand." I say, "I don't need to understand anything. Let her go." He hesitates, then lifts his hand up in the air releasing his grip, and the woman flees down the alley. I sense something. I turn my head and find 20 people gathered behind me, an impromptu backup gang for my confrontation. I am driving in the Mission District on my way home. I come upon a couple arguing. The woman has takeout food. She is offering it to the man. As I watch, he slaps it out of her hand onto the pavement. She recoils, then assumes that too familiar stance of trying to make things right. She picks it up. I hear her apologizing. I pull alongside. Do you need a ride? I know it is a risk for both of us. I don't care. She hesitates and says she's okay. I drive just a little way down the block. The volume of the argument increases. She turns, sees me still there. I recognize the pleading in her eyes. I back up and swing open the passenger door. His face is contorted, a twisted mask of disdain and hate. But she gets into the car, and at least for this moment, this time, she is safe. I walk the streets of the city dressed in black with my black motorcycle boots. I am bristling with rage because it seems everywhere I turn I see batterers. Everywhere I look, I am a witness to men who are abusing women. And I will throw my 118-pound fury directly in their path. I will make them wish they had never met me. Until finally the day comes when I realize this anger is consuming me instead of serving me. It is eating me up and leaving me bitter, lonely, fragmented. My deeds on the street, although sometimes offering temporary assistance rather than being truly helpful, are too often acts of self-exposure, putting me in harm's way again and again, with no thoughts of consequence, no concept of self-love. With this new understanding, I am able to move slowly towards healing. I start to think about surviving, both in a physical sense and in a metaphorical sense. I focus on who I can become instead of what has been taken from me. I turn deep into myself and find that I have my own reservoir of strength, one that is filled not with hatred and rage, but with compassion and hope. I begin to fight my battles with poetry instead of hammers. I sit down to write.
Beautiful.
I feel like I held my breath the whole time.
Absolutely beautiful. Wow.
Thank you.
I think this will be a good time to take a little music break.
Sounds good. And, wow.
Thank you so much for sharing. Could you introduce your song? Because you brought this song.
Sure, this will be a total break.
I know, huh?
I know. Okay, I brought a song by Coyote Grace called Summertime, or Girls Like Me. And the reason I like this song is it's about two young girls falling in love in the Midwest and making the whole town talk. And the reason I love this song is I tend to write a lot of really serious stuff. And I write protest poems and I write angry poems and write. And I love that kind of stuff. But this song is just joyful. It's just
like, here we are, and we're lesbians, and we're in love, and isn't that grand, and woo! And so
all right.
That's why I brought it. Thanks.
Stick with us, everyone. We'll be back shortly.
I was a watercolor girl in a tin-type town. The locals looked me up and down. Loved to watch the head spin when we come around. Me and my sweet baby. She was a tall glass of lemonade. Always had me sweating in the shade. Stole my first kiss from me in the first grade. Lord, I knew she was the one. Oh, berries in the bucket, babies on the blanket, tomatoes hanging heavy on the vine. Oh, the underwear's dancing to a Patsy Cline song out on the lawn.
So if you've just joined us, this is Living Proof, and our guest tonight is Michelle Wing. She just read us a beautiful spoken word piece, poetry piece about her own experience with rage. Thank you so much for that. Well, what a gift
you.
That was. Mm-hmm. We wanted to talk a little bit about domestic violence in the LGBT community, because I learned from you at these events, from Changing Hurt to Hope, that domestic violence is part of the LGBT community as well. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Yes. Part of what I do with the Y is go out and give community talks. And so one of the things we do is, you know, educate people about domestic violence in different communities. And one of the most important things to know about the LGBT community is, number one, it happens just as often in our community as it does in any other community. There's no difference there. So break that myth right away. But the difference is that in the LGBT community, LGBTQ, we'll just put everybody in there, but you know what I mean. I'm addressing all of y'all.
Yeah.
Is that our community faces different barriers and different obstacles and myths, which make our circumstances separate from a heterosexual couple. So, number one, it's sometimes more difficult to access services. There will be a fear of discrimination. You know, a LGBTQ person may be nervous about calling a hotline because, number one, they may feel like they have to out themselves in order to, you know, to call the hotline. And then when they actually do call the hotline, they think, is this person going to be okay with me saying that it's my girlfriend, boyfriend that's abusing me? Are they going to freak out about that? Are they going to act weird? So the nervousness about that. And then there might actually be a hostile reaction when they do call. There often are fewer services available, particularly for gay men. We just don't have very many shelters available for men. So most of the time a lesbian can stay at a women's shelter,
But men, we don't have shelters. And so that's something that is a real barrier. Mm-hmm. You know, where are they going to go?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there are, the whole issue of outing can be a problem, because the partner who is battering can threaten the other partner. If you leave, if the other partner isn't out, I will out you to your boss, your family, your, whoever you're not out to, that mm-hmm. that can be used against them. There can be a perception in society that the abuse is mutual, because it's a man and a man. So, it must be a mutual, it must be equal. Mm-hmm. Like if it's two men fighting, it's got to be a fair fight. If it's two women fighting, it's got to be a fair fight. It's easier for people to think if it's a man and a woman that it's
unequal. Woman,
yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so they'll be less likely to think that one is perceived as a victim. Or that they'll think it's consensual or whatever, So police will have a harder time when they show up with figuring out who's the batterer. You know, they have a harder time with that.
Even though the person is saying?
Yeah. It's just
directly, this is...
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So the LGBT people themselves will hesitate to call because they're embarrassed. You know, they think, how am I going to show that it was me? How am I going to, they're afraid of the prejudice and the embarrassment and they're perceiving that there might be discrimination. And sometimes, and oftentimes there really is discrimination. Mm-hmm. Another thing that can happen, specific threats with an LGBTQ batterer, they can refuse to use safe sex, divulge your HIV status. Those are things that can happen. Because the community is so small, if with an LGBTQ batterer, one thing that can happen is the batterer can try to get to the services first and monopolize them. Sometimes there are services available to LGBTQ clients, and so the batterer will try to get there first and use them. I've seen this, claiming that they're the victim. Mm. And then when the victim tries to go, then the other group will say, sorry, there's a conflict of interest. We've already been contacted by the other person, or something like that will happen. Wow. And then because it's such a small community, again, in most places, it's very hard to maintain anonymity. Once you've tried to get away or anything, it's very hard to maintain anonymity. So anyway, so there's a number of things that just make it, and we've fought so hard to say our relationships are valid and normal and good. There's a fear of coming out by saying I'm being battered by my spouse, because we don't want the heterosexual world to say, oh my God, you people are so abnormal. Look, you're beating up on each other, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want the negative attention right when we're working so hard to gain acceptance. So there's that fear too. So there's other layers. And then the last issue is just when there's children involved. A lot of times LGBT couples may not have full legal custody of the children involved. So if there's violence going on and one of the partner who's being battered wants to leave, they might not have legal recourse for visitation or to keep the children. And so that can be yet another barrier. So anyway.
That's huge.
Yeah.
That's a huge one. That's
opened our eyes to all that I hadn't thought about.
So anyway, so there's a number of things.
And so you brought a piece.
Yeah. So I actually, I am a survivor. I was in a relationship when I was quite young with a with a man that was violent. And then after I started dating women a number of years later, I was in a relationship with a woman that became emotionally and verbally abusive. And then when I tried to leave her, she stalked me, and it became really awful. And that was a real eye-opener for me, because I had sort of convinced myself that I was safe now, because I was with women. And so this poem is called Even a Woman. Even a woman. Every day I ran. The dog and I alone on a hiking trail, middle of the day, only our panting breath and footsteps to break the silence. Then back to our little cabin in the woods, where no one knew how to find me. I was in hiding. New town. I was in hiding. One of the disappeared. New town. Unlisted phone number. Quit the job I used to have because I could not afford to leave any trace. My self-esteem shattered. Startle reflex returned. Nightmares back like old friends. I had shrunk into that victim role, the one I thought I left so far behind. This caught me off guard, unprepared. All my armor still in the garrison. Weren't these wars over? I didn't know that even a woman could be an abuser. After months of bullying, tantrums, and road rage, disintegrating under her endless criticism and jealousies, I found enough courage to leave. And then she showed me just how much she loved me. The stalking began, her car outside my apartment at night, physical assaults at our gym, letters sent to my boss, harassing phone calls, an attorney hired to serve me with a restraining order, claiming I was the one emotionally unstable. I came for our day in court with an advocate, hoping for some kind of justice. The judge dismissed all charges. My girlfriend weighs 115 pounds, stands 5 feet 4 inches tall. I know the people in that courtroom were thinking, what is she afraid of? By then, I knew the truth. Even a woman can destroy your life.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing so deeply with us and the audience.
And just to share with all of our listeners, the YWCA hotline is 707-546-1234. So if you ever find yourself in any kind of a situation, please do call, and they are trained to take calls from anyone and will help you find the resources that you need.
So the barriers that you talked about, they would not be found at the YWCA.
We hope not. They all LGBT. Go through, yeah, they all go through a lot of training to be sensitive about that.
That's so excellent. That's good.
Excellent.
Well, we don't have that much time left. We have probably about 8 minutes or so. So
that's plenty of time to hear about your coming out story. We're not gonna let you leave without that piece.
So since you got everybody's like attention, like you're this wonderful writer and this beautiful, you know, soul and spirit, how did you come to be who you are?
Oh wow, in 8 minutes, huh?
Yeah. Not that long. So let us help you. Yeah. When did you come out, Michelle? In years, like how many years ago, or unless you want to say your age. Or.
Yeah, I came out officially, totally, when I was about 30.
Okay.
And it was, I was living in Japan, and I lived in Japan for 3 years, and the actual coming out followed. There were a number of mixed up, interesting things that happened before this. But the actual coming out happened following a series of three dreams. I had three beautiful dreams in the first three nights in a row. In the first dream, I was at a 1940s dance hall. I was dressed like a man, wearing a fedora and a white shirt and trousers, and I was dancing with a female mannequin. And then the next night, I dreamed again that I was at the dance hall. Mm. I was still dressed as a man, and this time I was dancing with a woman, but she didn't have a face. Mm. And then on the third night, we were back at that old dance hall, when wow. the music was playing. And this time I was wearing a little, 1940s print dress with little flowers and kind of a lace collar. And I was dancing with a live woman. Wow. We had our arms wrapped around each other.
Wow.
And I finally was able to, it took me forever to do it, but I did eventually write a poem about that called The Coming Out Waltz, where I tried to capture in the cadence. It's written in three parts, and so I tried to capture the cadence of the music mm-hmm. as well in the poem. Of course, I forgot to bring it tonight, but... So
there was actual music in your dream?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And you can still hear it.
Mm-hmm.
What a profound series of dreams.
Mm-hmm. So when you woke up the next morning after the third one, uh-huh. what did
you... It was just like, oh, that's it. Just like, it all came together. I mean, I had been obviously going through different parts of this process for some time. And when I had that dream, it was just the final click when I had that series of dreams. I've always had a very vivid dream life, and I've received a lot of messages from dreams. But that was... So I was... When that happened, I was... I think I was 28. And then I was in Japan till I was 30. And when I came home, I had been living previous to that. I grew up in Montana, and then I had moved to Seattle. And then from Seattle, I went to Osaka and Kyoto. And then when I came back to the United States, I moved to San Francisco. So I arrived and said, I'm here. I'm ready.
Uh-huh. Wonderful.
And that's when I really came out.
How was it in Japan as far as being gay? I mean, were you looking for, gay community there, or were you just really out at all? Or
I wasn't really looking for gay community mm-hmm. in Japan. It wasn't really, I wasn't aware of it there. Mm-hmm. It was very woman focused. I spent most of my time with women. And I had a very close friend there that I was totally crushed out on, that I spent most of my time with. But I wasn't, mm-hmm. in a gay community mm-hmm. there.
So you're way, way, way away from home at 30. So how did your mom and dad, how did your parents feel about your coming out? Did you tell them?
Threes are kind of magic numbers. I had to come out three times. So I came home, and first I told them in a letter, and that didn't stick. And then I told them on the phone, and didn't stick.
What do you mean didn't stick?
Well, they...
Didn't believe you?
They didn't believe me. Oh. Yeah. So I told them in a letter, and then I was talking to them on the phone, and they said, what are you talking about? And so I told them on the phone, about a month later. And then they said, what are you talking about on the phone? And then I was in person, and they said, I had just come back from a trip. I had gone to the Grand Canyon with a girlfriend, and I was showing pictures, and they're like, what are you talking about? So then I had to do it in person.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So.
And then they finally got it.
Yeah. And we went through the whole denial, and that's unnatural, and what are you doing, and blah, blah, blah. And then they completely came around and were great. And think my current relationship gave me total blessings, and think Sabrina's the best thing that ever happened to me, and all of that.
So, who's Sabrina?
Yeah.
Sabrina is my wife that I've been with for 10 years, and She's my rock.
Oh, well, aww. Shout out to Sabrina wherever
shout
you
out.
Are. Hey, didn't you? I know you got it. We got to go in about 2 minutes so we can close our show and everything. But you did tell us a very wonderful, cute story about when you were 10. I mean, it kind of just shows how your parents have come around. Is there any chance you'd like to share that with everyone or no?
I can just tell you briefly that when I was 10, I asked my parents for a sex change. I'd read about it in one of my mother's magazines about a tennis player or somebody. Anyway, uh-huh. I came downstairs and I said, sometimes God makes mistakes. I believe he made a mistake in my case. And here's the surgery. It's possible. I'd like to have this done. My mother cried. My dad laughed. And they said no.
Wow. And that was quite a while ago.
Yeah, some time ago. Right. And I must say that I'm glad that I didn't go through with it.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm now happy being a girl. It's all good.
Yeah. Well, gosh, thank you so much for being on our show tonight.
Thanks.
You know, we have a couple minutes. And so we always like to end our show asking our guests for advice to our listeners. So,
You can go in either direction, coming out or domestic violence, since it's hot and heavy this month. So whatever you want to offer, this is your opportunity.
I would say, I would say that I would talk about coming out. I think that it is critical that people come out. Because it's not just for you. It's for every kid that gets bullied in a classroom. It's for every Matthew Shepard. It's for every, you know, every single one of us that stands up, you know, can save somebody. And I really encourage everybody to come out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's so true, too.
Yes.
And I really want to thank you so much for...
Thank you for having me today.
Being
this
here.
This is really fun.
Helping us understand a little bit more deeply the whole domestic violence situation. And again, the Changing Hurt to Hope writers speak out against domestic violence is in because Domestic Violence Awareness Month is October. So not only is there National Coming Out Day, there's this important month that we are honoring.
It's also Breast Cancer Awareness Month as well.
Yes.
And I want to throw that out.
A lot of awareness.
Yeah. We need to be aware, people.
So we will need to close our show. We want you to remember that, like Michelle, you too can be living proof that through sharing your story, you can help our community be visible and be seen and be embraced as vibrant and proud and courageous. And until next month,
good night.
North Bay Public Media, KRCB FM, Windsor, Santa Rosa, on the air at 91.1 and 90.9 FM, streaming worldwide at krcb.org. Be sure to tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Music with Michaela Kennan. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. It's just before 9 p.m. Stay with us. Moyers & Company is next.